seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Hello, you're welcome along to Golf Weekly. It's Joe here and Nathan there. Hello, Nathan.
Hey, Joe.
And look who's back with his disgusting tan after 3 weeks in California. Fionn Davenport. Hello.
Hey, guys.
You were in California.
I was,
Should
yeah.
have mentioned that for
I did.
The last half an
Would
hour.
You? Oh, oh yeah. God. Have I not told you anything?
God. Yeah. I get the odd WhatsApp messages. You're going out to play golf around the time I'm heading to work. I've enjoyed that. Welcome back, buddy.
Thanks. Good to be back.
Irreplaceable. Well,
well not really. I heard Dave, heard Maliki.
Yeah. Dermot Galise and Stephen Brown.
Yeah.
On Friday in Castleknock.
Yeah. I heard it was good, even despite the horrific weather.
Well, it's our first podcast since Castleknock.
It is.
You should
listen. Three podcasts in a week.
Yeah, I know.
I don't want any more criticism from listeners about us not delivering.
Mm. Three times a week. That buys us a month off.
No, it doesn't. Because fair is where pigs win prizes. And that's, you know.
That's a little bit of class you bring to the podcast.
A little bit of culture.
I don't even know what that means, but I think you're right. Well, thank you to everyone who came to Castleknock.
Because everyone came.
Huge success. We had two dropouts. And considering the weather, that is impressive.
Even in sunny California, I was really sorry that I couldn't be.
Yeah, it's good.
While we're glad to have you back, Fionn, mm-hmm. it is a shame in one way that Dave McIntyre isn't here.
Yeah.
Because I think even 6 days on, he still hasn't quite got over the anger of the slow play around Castleknock.
Oof.
We literally had to talk him down from calling people out.
You're joking.
He wanted to get the entry list and figure out who was in front of us. Because he had pretty much identified who the slowest four ball was and was holding everybody else up.
Yeah.
He was angry.
There was one four ball causing a hell of a logjam.
In weather, though, you have to allow for that.
This was a bit above and beyond what might be.
Fairness to Dave. Dave is a quick player because usually after, like, he's hacked seven shots, he picks the ball up and goes, oh, I'm not going to score in this stupid hole anyway.
It's true.
Yeah.
And his swing takes 3 seconds less than anybody else's swing.
That's no pre-shot true. Routine to speak of. Just gets up, swings at it, goes.
He does have one of the best practice swings in amateur golf.
Ernie Els. Mm. So it was good, and we're very grateful everybody turned up. And it was just nice meeting Golf Weekly actual friends of the pod, you know. These off-the-ball road shows, I can't get away from the masses quick enough.
That's what fame is doing. It
is,
but
yeah.
No, I'm joking, obviously. But it's just lovely being in a room with people who have found the pod somehow and then have given up their Friday and they've come along in the rain. And they're there and it's just, it's nice. And there's a nice number of people. It's very intimate. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was a really good day. Yeah. And what I always find strange when you meet Golf Weekly listeners, and I know you've spoken before about meeting them in the supermarket, and that is, they generally don't introduce themselves.
Yeah.
They just pick up the conversation from something we've been talking about on the podcast the day before.
Yeah, that's true. Well, to me, they'll come up and say, friend of the pod. I get friend of the pod.
Do you?
Yeah, it's lovely. I was doing that TV3 show, the first one. I was very nervous and the audience were all there waiting, live TV, all that kind of stuff. And I had to run back because I'd forgotten a sheet or something. And there were these bunch of lads, just the kind of, you know, the people I'd be kind of thinking, oh God, they think this is all crap. You know that voice in your head? They think this is crap. They think this is useless. And they were just kind of sitting there, arms crossed, kind of staring, vacant, unimpressed with the whole thing. And they're the kind of people that kind of put me off a little bit. And so I ran out past them. And as I was running by, one of them goes, friend of the pod.
I had a guy come
instantly
up,
put me at ease.
I had a guy come up to me in a coffee shop, just walking by, saw me, and he just goes, "So, did you fix the driver?"
Nice.
And I was like, at first, I was like, "What?"
Yeah.
And then I was like,
"Started
oh, yeah,
crying."
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's
the answer is yes. By the way,
he has fixed the ips. But it's great meeting. It's great meeting actual friends of the pod. So, I think Nathan and I were just saying that, and I'm sure you'd be in agreement, Fionn. Friday at Castleknock just hardened our determination to have a really good golf day again in the summer, a Golf Weekly classic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Somewhere nice, barbecue, Q&A afterwards.
That's a very good idea. It's always a good idea.
And we have a sponsor coming down the line for Golf Weekly. Let's just say we all know what our favourite tour is.
There is only one
there
tour.
There is only one tour. Mm. I don't even know if there's an event on in America this year.
America.
Whatever.
Believe me, I was in America and yeah, the golf, it's not up to
it's
much.
It's not all that.
But no. Talking to the lads from Vox Golf who organised the last day, they were quite shocked at the dedication of the Golf Weekly listeners.
I know.
They sort of assumed that once everyone saw the weather, I was like, no, these are hardcore golfers.
They
don't mind the rain.
Because golf is, by definition, a hardcore sport.
Yeah.
And people, fans of it, and, you know, the real kind of ardent players, will generally play in any conditions, I think.
It was really bad. I mean,
okay, define how bad. Give me an idea.
Miserable. Just no.
Was it heavy rain or?
It was heavy at times. It was certainly heavy in the morning as you were deciding whether or not you were going to bail. It was heavy.
It was cold.
It was really windy, really cold. You're only getting 9 holes.
There's like, no shelter.
It's not like we had Padraig Harrington there afterwards. Like, Gleese and Stephen Brown were brilliant. But, you know, the Q&A is also missable and you're going to get it on podcast as well. I actually think people might have bailed on a bigger event, but because they understood that they were taking places that other people wanted, and also they understand that, like, we're breaking our balls to do it at times, honestly think a lot of them said, I won't let the lads down.
Yeah, well, we had a lot of people when I was picking out the winners, randomly, of course, randomly, and I was saying, do you want one or two places? Loads of people came back and said, I've a mate who'd like to play, but he's not a friend of the pod.
Yes, that's the attitude. It's a special, it's a special thing we're part of, and nights like Friday night remind me of that, actually.
Yeah,
it's more special than off the ball in many ways. It's just it's very niche. It's a lovely thing. Makes me emotional. Can I read out some tweets from the weekend? Aaron McCollorum.
Aaron McCollorum?
McCollorum.
Who won?
Who won. He won.
So
he is representing the Golf Weekly Massive in the Vox Golf Final now to see if he can win a trip to Augusta. And Aaron, we want to know how you get on. So he said, finally I got a mention on Golf Weekly NT. It's the hacker's equivalent to a golf major grand slam. He did get
what
a
Aaron play off?
11.
Solid.
21 points.
21 points.
And he scratched the first, which is one of the, if not the easiest hole in the course.
Yeah, short par four.
Yeah.
You go
21 points with a scratch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Through nine in that
amazing
weather. Yeah, no, Aaron, you've got a chance in the final. Go well. Sean Clancy quoted something I said to Dermot Gleese, which was, I'd say you know everything. Probably does. Gleese was on top.
He's been to
storytelling form.
Is it 100 majors he's been to?
Yeah,
that's unbelievable.
He remembers
like
a lot.
Been to 100.
It's
majors.
Unbelievable. But
he only started covering Augusta.
That's what I was going to say.
In the late 80s.
Okay, so it's 20. So it's you go to all four for 25 years, but still, that's a lot of majors.
It's good. Yeah. It is good. So Gleese was very good, and Sean Clancy calls him hashtag the Golf Father. Rembot says, I remember marshalling the last day at the K Club in 06 and getting the Monty stare as spectators put up their brollies. We talked Monty. And they both had great things to say about Monty, actually. And there's a Paul McGinley interview coming up on Off the Ball next week where McGinley was talking about Tiger and how Tiger distracted him when he was playing with him because Tiger was so brilliant. And we talk about that for a while. And I said, did anyone else distract you with their brilliance? He said, bum, bum, bum. The other person who really did was, and it might surprise you, Monty.
Yeah, 8-time winner of the European Order Merit. Eighth. Yeah.
It's just because he wasn't very long and he'd hit this fade and you'd think people just got used to it or took it for granted. But McGinley just said the control he had over the ball was,
I was gonna say,
stunning.
He mightn't be, okay, so let's say, for example, he's with a 4-iron in his hand. Monty could sit there and go, you see that, I don't know, whatever. See that tree? I'm gonna fade it 5 yards off that tree.
Yeah.
And he'd do it every time. That's impressive.
Interestingly, Stephen Brown used the example of Monty with his 4-iron as well.
Do you think Monty has an attitude of, that old school sports attitude of, you haven't played the game? So he has this respect for other golfers.
Yeah.
So when he stands on the tee and he's with Stephen Brown, who Monty, let's be fair, was at a completely different level to, he was, all right, we're part of the same game here. But pretty much everybody else, Monty's, you don't know anything.
I think that's a fair point.
You're still between the ropes.
I think he's entitled to have that opinion.
And yet he comes up against a problem when he's sitting in the skybox on major coverage. Remember when he was sat next to Jack Nicklaus and Jack Nicklaus gave him the, well, you've never won a major, so I don't know. He goes, this is not like any other 18 holes of golf, he said about one last day. And Nicklaus is going, yes, it is. That's precisely how you have to think about it.
That's where you went wrong, my friend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, funnily enough, when you're talking to pundits and you're trying to give them advice about what's good, and that's like, you know, drawing your own experiences. Drawing your own experiences. People want to hear about that. With Monty, it's the complete opposite.
Yeah, don't.
Like, please stop bringing up the past.
The Ryder Cup. Don't talk about the Ryder Cup.
Well, I think he's entitled to bring up the past if somebody collapses in a major and he brings up the US Open.
He had a 7-iron in the middle of the fairway.
Yeah. A billion times out of a billion and one times.
He would have made it.
Correct.
And do you know what? And to castigate Monty is really mealy-mouthed and small.
Sure.
For that. Because that's just horrible. And you wouldn't wish that on anyone. And someone who's won the Order of Merit as many times as Monty, has credentials. He's got golfing chops.
It's beyond. We don't even need to state that. I was just surprised that Paul McGinley, who's played with everyone and played with Tiger Woods even 20 times, when I asked him who was the other, what other golfer jumps to mind as someone who was so good they distracted you from your own performance?
And given the tortured politics between them over Ryder Cup captaincy, that is quite the compliment.
I was just surprised he said Monty was next in that list. He said I'd almost have him as number two. Declan Power wonders if this or any of your pods are on SoundCloud. Thanks, Declan. We can barely get around to recording these things, let alone put them up in SoundCloud. Pro V1 Kenobi, he's back. He's one of the many people who finally got around to ordering this being Slaying the Tiger by Shane Ryan. On your recommendation, just need an exotic location to read it while listening to the pod. Indeed you do. We're putting Shane Ryan's kids through college. So
community college.
Open Golf said, if Golf Weekly and T-Pod makes it through the legal department this week, well worth a listen for Dermot Cleese's thoughts on Gary Player. Yes, and that podcast is up. We'll play you a snippet of what Dermot was saying about Tiger. Shay Cullen, Joe, it was great to meet so many like-minded people at the News Talk outing, not unlike a Star Trek convention, I imagine.
Oh, that's terrible. No.
I know that. Look, for the onlookers, it was a Star Trek convention.
Because the clubhouse in Castleknock is a restaurant as well, so there was a lot of other people in there. And you know, you would kind of think, oh, there's a radio show just down the corner. Yeah. Maybe I'll pop down and see what's going on. It might be interesting. There was a definite look of everybody else in the restaurant going, oh, nerd heaven down there.
It was so nerdy. Ian Sweeney, I caught up in the last pod while on the way up to the Fruit Lodge and Span, the Swiss Alps.
Impressive.
That is impressive. Not as impressive as the tube, but it looked nice. Fintan Harrington, thanks for a great afternoon on Friday, minus the weather, lads. Looking forward to the next outing, hopefully in the sun. I think anyone who turned up on Friday has an excellent chance of being randomly selected for our golf outing come the summer, and that's only fair. Stephen, what's with Phil dressed as the Fonz in the Ferrazzi interview? That's a hell of a question. We'll play you some of Phil, actually.
Have you found the full interview?
No, you?
No.
We'll play you a clip of what he was talking about. He was dressed like the Fonz. Leather jacket, hair slicked back. What was it Richie McCormack said? Like an old man really, really trying to look young.
Yeah, he's in a permanent midlife crisis right now, Phil.
It's doing well for him, though.
Bastide boy. Enjoyed you and Dave and Malachy. He said, good podcast this week, lads. Perhaps time for Joe Malloy to be Ranieri'd. Taking it as far as he can.
Wow. I know how you feel, Joe.
You're already forgotten.
I'm not even going to go with you. It was a very good pod. I thought Malachy struck a very good tone on the whole.
Well, interestingly, right? Malachy text because he clearly, bizarrely, listens to what we think about golf and said, with Fiona May, I'll happily come on. And we said, oh, that's great. And we just said, Malachy is like perfect. Anytime he wants to come on, welcome.
He's good. He's great.
I'll step out for Malachy to come on anytime. Mm. Yeah. He's excellent. Yeah.
I won't get back in.
I wish he'd write more about golf.
There was nothing.
Malachy, go on, get on it.
You guys were talking about the Rory Trump thing. Mm. So I was in America for that. I swear you couldn't find one column inch of reference to it in any of the US publications. Yeah. Not a one.
I understand that, really, because did we flip out when Ernie Els played with him, or even when Tiger Woods did?
Yeah, Ernie Els pulled out of a tournament to play with him.
It's more that we feel Rory, to some extent, is ours and he's representing us to some extent. Obviously, that's just our perception, and he could say, well, no, I'm not. I'm representing myself and nobody else. But, you know, it's understandable they wouldn't care that much if McIlroy played with him, whereas for us, it was a sense of, oh, God, can we stand over this and still love Rory?
No.
We get a lot of tweets about it. Please stop talking about Trump.
Yeah.
Rename it Politics Weekly.
We should do that.
Yeah.
Right, let's move on and talk about the week's action. So, Mexico for the WGC, Dustin Johnson was a huge success for many reasons, including this.
Si es Justin Thomas, hoyo 13, es un par 3. Tercera ronda, aquí viene el de los Estados Unidos, Justin Thomas, con un estupendo swing. Aquí viene, va a querer el green, estupendo. Uno, bote adentro. Gol. Y one, otro en uno. Es fabuloso, increíble. El México Championship se rinde ante Justin Thomas. Hoyo en uno, lo celebra la gente, vuelta loca. Hole in one de Justin Thomas.
My favourite part is that he goes, hole in one.
Yeah, yeah, just in case.
There are certain phrases which still going, which survive. Because I remember watching Martin Keimer destroy the field at the US Open in Brazil for the World Cup. And it was interesting to learn the different words. But Birdie survives. Mm. Birdie Keimer. Birdie.
Pretty good.
Goal!
Hole!
Was he saying hole or
he
goal?
He meant hole.
Hole!
That's what he meant. He went hole!
Birdie Keimer.
In one.
Birdie Keimer. Oh!
That was the best idea the PGA Tour have had in years.
Going to Mexico? Or
no,
having
Golf Channel. Whoever decided to get
to
that
have the Mexican feed.
Yeah. That wasn't live. That didn't actually happen.
Oh, really?
No, they asked him afterwards to do it.
Ah, for God's sake. Well, I wouldn't have played it if that was the case. That's
well
too
done,
contrived.
Nathan. Thanks a lot.
Way to ruin it.
Jeez.
So we'll promptly move on then. Mexico for the WGC. So Dustin Johnson, back-to-back wins, a fourth WGC, an endorsement of his status as the world number one. Just 12 months ago, Dustin Johnson was the nearly man in golf. Mm. And now he's all-conquering and increasingly dominant world number one, Dustin Johnson.
Well, he was the nearly man and coming off the back of an absence from the game where he was just seen as this party boy who won tournaments, won a year consistently every year for what, 8-9 years now, but just didn't have the mentality to fulfill his talent.
It was as if his talent was winning the occasional big tournament in spite of his preparation. Mm. He was just so bloody good, he could pierce through that crap and still win the occasional tournament. But now,
then he started practicing his wedges.
He's practicing his wedges. He looks lean. He looks fit. He looks as focused as Dustin Johnson's ever looked. I don't think he's ever going to be the most intense of competitors. But, I mean, he was in brilliant form. You guys watched a lot of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not just the sheer amount of tournaments he's winning. It's the quality of the fields he's beating. Mm. So he wins the World Golf Championship Mexico. 49 of the world's top 50 are there. Yeah. Only Jason Day is missing. That follows up in winning the LA Open, which is one of the better PGA Tour events. You look back over the last year or so at the events he's won. The BMW Championship, the Bridgestone Invitational, the US Open, the Cadillac Championship, the HSBC Championship. Every one of them is packed with the top 50 in the world.
Yeah.
So he's not turning up at the Valspar Championship and just notching up a win here and there.
Yeah.
Every single time, no matter what type of course it seems as well, he can win on it.
Interestingly, another feature of his win was that across the 4 days, he missed 16 putts from inside 10 feet.
Yeah, that was interesting because one of the standouts definitely on the final day was how good his short game was. In particular, his play from the bunker, which saw the shot on 127 yard. Like he was playing it down, he called it a dink. But the angle was really difficult. Mm. And that was twice, there was it 14 or 15 he had a shorter shot from the side of the green. Again, seemingly very difficult to get it. One of these shots, the commentator says, if he gets it within 10 feet of here, he'll be doing very well. Mm. And he gets it within 10 feet. So I was watching that, looking at those stats, thinking, oh, maybe now you can consider Dustin Johnson as a contender for the Masters because his short game has improved so much. Whereas then you hear he's missed so many putts that actually, while he probably can win the other three majors this year, you wouldn't really think he has the game to win around Augusta.
He's gone in as now second favourite at Augusta in the very latest
to Jordan Spieth.
Betting. Jordan Spieth is 6-1. They have Dustin Johnson right behind him at 7s. Rory McIlroy is at 8. And then a bit of a gap from those three to the next. That's Jason Day and Hideki Matsuyama at 14-1. So the bookies see this as Spieth versus Johnson versus McIlroy. We'll get on to McIlroy in a moment. But Johnson, okay, the putting is definitely an issue. The greens were troublesome for quite a few players.
Yeah, except for I think Spieth had a good day on the greens.
Yeah.
He had a bad driving. But Johnson shot 31 on the front nine on the Saturday, and then did he shoot 32 or 31 on the front nine on the Sunday. Mm. So he absolutely owned the front nine. Beautiful eagle on the Saturday on the first. Mm. Like, it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then kind of, as you said, like he slipped up a bit, couple of bogeys on the back nine. But like, he just owned it. And in fairness, Justin Thomas kind of rallied to get the lead. John Rahm.
Our boy John Rahm.
John Rahm had the lead. Like, yeah. Shared the lead. And like,
9 holes to go looked like John Rahm was going
yeah,
to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And just
Tommy Fleetwood.
Oh yeah, Tommy Fleetwood. Did you see the high five with the caddy?
Yeah.
The awkward
the
high five.
Smashed him in the face because they were trying to high five.
He tried to high five him, but he actually hit him in the face.
Snedeker came on late as well. So Rahm's definitely proving his credentials as a guy who's going to be
And he's going to play, he's going to take up European Tour membership.
Yeah.
So he will be able to play a Ryder Cup, because we had spoken about that when he won the tournament last month,
yeah.
That he had said at the time he wasn't yet committed to the European Tour, but obviously he's, what's he, 22 in the world right now, he can play wherever he wants.
22 years old. Do you know who he started playing money games with? Phil.
Oh no.
Well, Phil's brother is his coach.
Oh yeah, that's right.
The good news for Phil's brother left his position full time at the university
to go with John Rahm.
Yeah.
And then he left John Rahm last weekend to go caddying for Phil. Just for the couple of days.
Okay.
Because Bones, like a lot of them down in Mexico, the food didn't go down too well.
Oh yeah, there was a lot of upset tummies, wasn't there? Yeah. McIlroy and a few
Bones,
others.
Yeah.
So the good news for McIlroy is he can come back from these layoffs and be desperately undercooked and can take 3 months to get himself going again. At least he looked to get back relatively well into the groove of things. Or no?
It felt like a very typical Rory tournament of last year when he wasn't winning, in that he started really well and then it just kind of came to nothing. Average day. Now, he wasn't putting particularly well over the first couple of days. It was just he had it on a string time and time again, but it wasn't one of these weeks where Rory put himself in contention because he was on with the putter. He wasn't. And then I think at the weekend the putter stayed the same.
Yeah.
He was one under. He was one under well. For the weekend. Now, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that after his layoff. Obviously, he had the lead after 2 days.
Well, you see, you'd think if it was rust, he would grow into the tournament. Mm. Actually, it would go the other way, you know.
Well, it's a bit of fatigue as well. Like, he's not match fit. And
he was sick.
And also, as well, he's been chased by the world's hottest players.
Yeah.
And it's not like staying level just isn't enough. Like, staying level, you're going backwards. Mm. You have to go lower. And I think, in fairness, I think Rory will come away from the weekend going, this is a really, really good week for me because I was fit, I stayed healthy, I showed a bit. He finished tied seventh.
Yeah, no, once he's hitting the ball well, that's a massive start. It takes away a lot of the angst, which I had thought he might have for the next month. So he also managed to muster a vaguely genuine smile on 18 for Johnson when they shook hands. You know, he wasn't like through gritted teeth.
But would he ever be?
No.
I never thought of Rory as the
No,
the
I also think
loser.
He looks at Dustin Johnson as our long-term rival.
Yeah.
I think he looks at Spieth as the guy that he's going to be battling out with for the next 10 years.
Sorry, say that again?
I don't think Rory looks at
Johnson,
as even though Johnson is world number one playing unbelievable
golf.
Yeah.
Sorry, I see what you
think
mean.
So?
I don't. I think he looks at probably Dustin Johnson. Dustin Johnson probably win 4 majors, but God knows when.
Yeah.
I think that's a very good point.
They're in Florida this week for the Valspar Championship. Once upon a time, the Tampa Bay Classic. So won by Schwartzel last year, won by Jordan Spieth the year before that at Innisbrook in Florida. Henrik Stenson, 8-1 is the favourite. Justin Thomas, who we just mentioned, throwing his clubs around a bit, actually, in Mexico, is second favourite.
Three times.
12s. Ryan Moore, 22. Actually, it's not a very good field. We're into Daniel.
No.
Daniel Berger is the fourth favourite. Yeah. Matt Kuchar, 25-1. Patrick Reed, 25-1. So that's so-so. I must say, and it may just be me, up until the week just gone, I was finding it hard to watch golf for just enjoyment because I really wanted to watch golf. I'm not sure if it's coincided with being back playing. And maybe for me, I need to be playing to really watch it and enjoy it. But I don't know, is that just me?
It's only warming up, I know, really, the season.
I know, but usually I've, like, from Florida, from Hawaii on, I've been happily into it. A few people mentioned it to me at the Golf Weekly Classic. A few of the listeners had said that usually they'd be all over the golf, but just at the moment, wasn't quite doing it for them. Now, that's a small sample size. I'm talking about two people and me, but just throwing it out there.
The Florida swing is having a real problem, though. That Mexico has really thrown a spanner in the works.
How so?
Well, so you have the Honda, okay, and then obviously this week's Valspar. They're not done any favours because you have only two players in the top 10 are playing Valspar. They couldn't get Jordan Spieth, who Jordan Spieth won 2 years ago there, and that sparked his, you know, his unbelievable season. No player in the top five. Okay, Spieth, Johnson and Mickelson won't play an event in Florida in this shorter 3 week period. Even Nicklaus is saying, and Nicklaus, and I'm quoting, "I don't think going from LA for the Genesis Open to here, to the Honda Classic, to Mexico City is very good." He told the Treasure Coast newspapers, "should be going from LA to Mexico to here." So the Florida swing, rather than being interrupted by Mexico, it should all just be 1 3 week swing in Mexico. And there is a real issue. And so it's about kind of changing the order of things. But then enter the boss of our favourite tour, Keith Pelly. There's kind of an interesting bit of politics at play here. So the solution for the PGA would be to move the WGC to the week after the Genesis Open, and then you would have a clean run at the Florida Swing. So you have the three events in Florida back to back. And that kind of makes sense. But it doesn't really. And that is because you have Keith Pelly, who rebuffed the move to do that because of the European Tour schedule. So you have the Super 6 event that was in Perth, right? Is the same week as the Genesis Open. And the thinking that it would be like a crazy long way to go from Western Australia to Mexico. And so rearranging the Mexicos, they're like, no, they're not going to do it. And so they've really held firm. And they're trying to, you know, so basically it's the idea of trying to muscle the European Tour into an inconvenient date for their WGC. And or do you remember last year for the Bridgestone, they rearranged the Bridgestone to suit the Olympics? And that didn't work that well. Yeah. So Keith Pelly's holding quite firm. And we don't know what'll happen to the Florida Swing, which has been such an integral part of kind of warming up the golf season ahead of the Masters. Yeah. But at the moment, it's not been, this year is not good.
I think the two feed into each other. What you're saying about not a lack of interest, but struggling to get that excited. Mm. There's too much golf and the players can't play every single week. So like the Valspar Championship isn't a big tournament.
No.
Why would the best players in the world turn up? It was the Tampa Bay Classic back in the day.
Yeah.
But it's not a World Golf Championship. Arnie's tournament is struggling to get players. Henrik Stenson isn't going to play in the next World Golf Championship, the match play.
Wow.
Because he said, well, funnily enough, he's not playing for the entire reason they changed it. He said, it's not really match play anymore when it's a group.
Yeah.
It should be straight knockout. Now, maybe that's an excuse.
When's Arnie's tournament?
3 weeks? No.
Okay.
And that's a real problem. Nathan's dead right. Spieth, Garcia, Scott, Justin Thomas, Patrick Reed and Phil Mickelson have all said they're not playing.
Wow.
The Arnie tournament, and this is the year after Arnie died. Like, yeah. You think there'd be this, you know, outpouring of support, you know, and tribute to the king.
Let's keep this a big tournament.
No. And so all you have is like as the headliners, you've got Rory, Ricky Fowler, Jason Day and Hideki Matsuyama, which isn't a bad...
No, that would be very watchable. But
it's very watchable. But
I would have thought someone like Phil would make a big play on being
absolutely
there for the
Arnie thing. And again, it's to do with the Masters and WGC because all the golfers, or most of the golfers, they like to play the week before the Masters. So if they play Houston and the match play, that's three straight tournaments leading up to the Masters, and that's one tournament too many.
Have we been a little bit spoilt, though, over the last couple of years? One of the reasons maybe why the excitement levels don't get as high. So that when you look at a field like the Valspar Championship, you go, yeah, whatever. It is only the maybe 10 times a year now you can really get up for it. When you're looking and going, all right, Rory's playing.
Yeah.
Spieth is playing.
Yeah.
Day is playing. Phil, Dustin.
Yeah.
And that's when you're interested.
Whereas
if one of them is there, it's grand.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're spoiled. I think we just want WGCS quality fields all the time. Can I just play you this? Because we have to move on because shortly we're going to be talking to Pat Finn, who's the CEO of the GUI, the Golf Union of Ireland, about they're having a handicap awareness month because lots of you out there are minding your handicaps. We know what's happening. But Phil Mickelson has sat down with David Faherty for Faherty's show, and we mentioned Matt Kuchar there, who is playing in the Valspar Championship, and Phil was talking, Fionn, you love this, Phil was talking about the banter.
The
banter on tour. But it's here's a little snippet. I haven't seen the Faherty thing yet, but they released this as a promo clip, so we thought we'd play it for you.
Who's the best trash talker on tour? I mean, you're up there.
Paul Azinger was my guru.
Yeah.
He was the one that I tried to emulate. So now, clearly Matt Kuchar, okay? I have nothing for Matt Kuchar.
Yeah.
I strolled up one day on the driving range wearing, I had just gotten these gator skin Augusta green shoes and belt. David, this was tight, okay? I knew I looked good.
Yeah.
All right, well, I walk up there and Kuch goes, what are those? I go, oh no, Matt, you've got to win 3 green jackets to wear these. That was my best line.
Yeah.
And he says, without a second despair, he says, well, let's just hope I only win 2. I have nothing for him.
Hey, come on.
That's
pretty funny.
Awful.
It's not awful.
It's awful.
Fionn.
That's poor.
It's not poor.
It compares nothing to Shane Warne, the sledging king.
But these are mates. They're not actually trying to sledge each other. They're just having a bit of fun.
Let's hope I only win 2 because you're wearing a shitty pair of shoes.
It's a joke. It's a joke about how bad the shoes are.
It's not good.
It's such a Phil story.
It is such a Phil story.
What's wrong with you? And thank God we have Phil because the rest of them are dull as dishwater.
But it's what's so great about every Phil story
Is
how much Phil enjoys Phil stories. Hey. He enjoys them more than anybody else in the world. You know,
I'm not hearing a bad word against him. It's like, I'm pulling down both your faders so only I can talk. No, your fader's down. Can't hear you. Go on.
Kind of telling like stories that are like not even vaguely amusing.
No, fader down. Sorry.
It is funny though that you're saying, oh, Phil, like Phil's hilarious.
Yeah.
That.
Well, I never said that.
You
think Phil's hilarious.
It sums up part of the problem golf has when Matt Kuchar is the second funniest guy on the PGA Tour.
That was disappointing that like Kuchar was his... Kuchar's the one guy. Like,
yeah. Phil Mickelson's been on tour since the early 90s. And David Faraday, which you assume would have given Phil a heads up of the questions he's going to ask him. And one of them is, we're going to talk about banter, so I'm going to ask you who your favourite comeback quip is. Like, in his 25 years on tour, this is the... Like, come on.
Well, do you really think... If you were in that position, you could tell the genuine.
No, but
funny
you can
stories.
Come up with a better tellable one than that one.
You believe that the players all love Phil? Like, Phil tells these hilarious stories.
I do.
He's sort of bullying everybody else on tour, and he invites them to the game on a Tuesday, and
I think
psychologically messes with them.
But I think the truth is somewhere in between. I think Phil has friends on tour. Like, he has a gang of friends that he gets on well with, and I think a lot of others couldn't care less about him, and that's fine.
Is that not true
of
us all?
That's what I mean. Yeah, it's true of us all.
There's lots of people who don't care about Nathan Murphy.
No, but...
Who are these people?
No, my point is that oftentimes when we're talking about the popularity or lack thereof of a PGA pro, we kind of tend to go into this binary state where he's loved by all, he's hated by everybody. It's like, you know, Bubba is the least popular guy on tour. Nobody likes Tiger. I often think with a guy like Phil, who, you know, I think some people like him, some people don't care about him, and probably there's a handful of people who think he's a bit of a dick, and that's fine.
That's all fine.
And that's the way it is.
I just played that clip for some light relief. I didn't think it would become a contentious issue. Well, can we not all agree that at least Phil makes an effort? Phil makes an effort.
Yeah.
Phil makes an effort to be engaging and entertaining.
Yeah,
and
he's...
God
damn
it, I won't have you
shooting
down for it.
He's like,
what's
his face in Tim Cup? He's like, Shooter McGavin.
No, that's harsh.
That's a cliche, unfair version of Phil. He is not Shooter McGavin. Initially, I thought he was, but he's definitely got a lot more about him. Come on. So will we move on then? Oh, by the way, mention of Bubba Watson, finally, seeing as you mentioned everyone hates Bubba, he is playing in the field at 40-1. There's a good piece by Philip Reed in the Irish Times.
Yeah.
Just pointing out, it's just kind of crept along here, Watson's best finish with the Masters on the horizon, where he's obviously been so effective in the past, is tied 25th at a limited field tournament of champions in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Other than that, Bubba, he's had a blowout. He's had a miscut at the Phoenix Open where he lives. He's had a withdrawal with no reason given from the Genesis Open, which he was defending. And he finished tied for 38th in Mexico. So, and Watson, interestingly, is said to have lost a stone in body weight since last year.
Philip Reed makes that point. And that, like, there's a guy 6'3".
Yeah.
And he's down to, is it 12 stone?
12 and a half stone.
That's skin and bones for a guy
skin and bones, yeah. Like Reed says, you'd be inclined to cry halt and say enough is enough. You're a golfer, not a clothes horse. But, there's no kind of intimation that Watson is ill or anything like that. It was just an observation in a much bigger article. But, Watson want to sort that out because that's very poor.
Well, there was a reason he was left out of the Ryder Cup team despite being seventh in the world, was that his game had collapsed. Mm. Like, he should have been an automatic pick.
Yeah.
There shouldn't have been any question about it. One other thing before you go. You mentioned Charles Schwartzel as the defending champion. Poor old Charles was playing in the Pro-Am yesterday. Worst nightmare.
Oh.
Got whacked with the ball by one of his Pro-Am partners.
Oh, God.
Straight in the wrist.
Oh, no. Is he okay?
He pulled out of the Pro-Am straight away.
Yeah.
Swelled up, but he reckons he's going to be okay.
Sorry, I actually feel for the guy who did it.
I could be wrong, but I have heard a story. Feel free to edit this out, Joe, but you may be able to elaborate on it. It was before I worked here.
Mm-hmm.
That a former News Talk employee at an Irish Open Pro-Am.
I was 100%. There. I saw it happen.
a former CEO.
CEO of News Talk was playing the Pro-Am up in Portrush. He decided, of the three amateurs, he'd go, I'll drive first.
Sorry,
feel
this is on the
confident.
First tee.
On the first tee.
A lot of nerves.
There was thousands. I'm not saying
who's
a thousand.
With?
We were playing with
Gregory Bordy.
Yeah.
Gregory Bordy.
Yeah, so Gregory Bordy tees off,
from Bulgaria.
Hits one down the first. And so the aforementioned CEO, we just decided between us who wants to hit first.
Yeah.
And he goes, yeah, I'll hit first. And confident guy hits up and slices one off. And you could see it. What's the worst sound in golf? Is 2,000 people all going, like this as he hit a woman square in the middle of the forehead, knocked her clean out. What? The next thing we saw was a St. John's ambulance applying their restorative powers. And yeah, I mean, turns out she was fine. But it didn't stop us spending the entire pro-am round asking the aforementioned CEO if the onset of brain damage, how long do you think it would take?
Wow.
Apparently she died.
Wow.
So
I mean,
it's funny
that story escalated.
I have a lot of sympathy for him because you can
so
imagine how much you'd be looking forward to playing in the pro-am at Portrush.
Yes.
And on the first hole, it ruins your day.
Well, actually, oddly enough,
did
it ruin the first six or seven holes, yeah, because he blanched.
You'd be shaken, yeah.
But I have to say, impressively rallied. There's a guy who played off 11. Impressively rallied and had an absolutely brilliant back nine.
Okay.
Played in Portrush. Mm. Not an easy course.
Heartless.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he played CEO. Well. No, it, and just no, listeners, bacon. Just in case, yeah, she didn't die, she actually was fine.
No, she's fine. Everything's
gone
fine.
On to live a very,
well,
very successful.
I don't know how long or how successful the life was.
Now
but
stop
she,
it. Come on, everyone.
Definitely live.
Right, let's
day.
Straighten up. There is stuff we're going to talk about at the end of this pod, which will include Mike Davis from the USGA talking about a golf ball which may only go 80% of the distance.
Oh, so Bubba's playing a new golf ball. Did you notice that?
A pink one.
No. He's stopped with Titleist. He's playing some golf manufacturer nobody's ever heard of.
Oh, and maybe you want to get back on in the old Titleist. But so we'll talk about that. Mike Davis and Graham McDowell were saying he was all for it, you know, like maybe an 80% distance golf ball to stop certain courses becoming obsolete or them having to tear up the 17th at the old course. And there'll be a few other bits and pieces besides. Steve Stricker is worried about Tiger Woods. But up next, he's probably waiting outside, so Nathan's going to run and get him. It's Pat Finn, who's the CEO of the GUI, because they're having a handicap awareness month, so it'll be interesting to talk to him about all that. So we are joined in studio by greatness, everybody. Pat Finn is the CEO of the GUI, the Golf Union of Ireland. Pat, welcome to the greatest golf podcast maybe in the world.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
As CEO of the Golfing Union of Ireland, so technically responsible for everything good that happens in golf in Ireland, when Shane Lowry wins a tournament, when Paul Carrington wins a tournament, do you just pat yourself on the back and say,
yeah,
that's all me?
Yeah, every time. Yeah, I'd love to be able to claim responsibility for their ability, but no. Sorry.
How long have you been CEO of the GUI?
2 years-ish, but right. I was in the kind of head position, which was formerly called General Secretary, since 2011, so I guess I've been in the main role since then, but okay, it was changed slightly a few years back.
And when did you first join the GUI in 2011?
No, 1998. So I can claim responsibility for Graham as well as Shane and Rory, yeah.
So why has it worked so well? What has the GUI done?
In terms of performance on the golf course, I think the key ingredients of a high performance system are there, and they've been there for donkey's years. We've got the golf courses, which are obviously vital. We've got really good coaches. The PGA coaches in Ireland are really obviously well qualified and super operators, know what they're doing. And then we've got a really good competitions program where we run 60 domestic championships every year,
right,
for golfers at all levels, all ages. They're the main components. And then on top of that, we plug in an overseas competitions program, which the guys in more recent years have benefited from. So Rory would have been at the start of that, where we send players all over the world playing in championships.
And do you fund those trips?
We do,
as well?
Yeah. Yeah, we do. Well, they're funded. Well, we help fund them together with Sport Ireland. Right. Yeah, that's the main funding.
And I know you're here to talk about handicap awareness in the amateur ranks, but so, for instance, what happens when you hear that there's a 9 or 10-year-old who's rather good up the road somewhere?
It normally, the provincial branch of the GUI would find out about these excellent youngsters, and yeah, they'll come to a talent identification day or session, and then they enter into our high performance program, which essentially starts at branch level and then leads its way up to a national program.
So, how old are these? Like, how old do you spot a kid at, or how young rather?
Yeah, and normally to get into a provincial coaching program, 12, 13 would be the youngest. Younger than that,
too late for me anyway.
Yeah.
And would they be coached on a very regular basis, or check in every 2 or 3 months?
It's you know, 4 or 5 times during the off season. They right. come to provincial coaching sessions. So the contact time isn't that significant. It's something we're changing, actually. Last year, or in the last coaching season, we coached 740 players around Ireland as part of the GUI's program and the provincial program. We're going to reduce that to almost half and have more contact time.
Because that's an interesting one, because I presume a lot of the prodigies, not just in Ireland but around the world, would have their own Michael Bannon.
Yeah.
And they would say, well, he's my guy and I don't want, as much as I love Neil Manship, I'm comfortable with my guy. So how does all that work?
Well, that's between Neil and Michael in Rory's case. I mean, Rory obviously was on teams under Neil. Neil's role with players is more around skills development as opposed to, you know, trying to change the golf swing. By the time they get to a national program, the guys know how to swing a golf club.
Right.
And then Neil plays a massive role in actually, you know, supporting the team at the event, which is not coaching as such. It's performance management. It's a different thing. Mm. Course management and all sorts of other skills come into it. And then, of course, the national program has more bits and bobs added onto it, like, you know, a fitness program, yoga, nutrition, and all those kinds of things. Mm. Yeah.
One of the better younger players in Irish golf at the moment, someone I've kept an eye on over the last few years, is Kevin LeBlanc, who I randomly ended up playing 18 holes with in Balcarrick about 5 years ago. And I think the day before he had won the Irish under 14 or under 15 championship. Yeah. When you have someone like him and as talented as he is, what's the end goal? When do you let go of him? When do you give the sort of advice as to, well, now is the time you really need to start looking at turning professional?
Yeah, well, we've supported Kevin since he was around that age, 13, 14. He's now 18. He's a few more years to go yet before he ought to be thinking about turning pro. He's making his international debut this week at the Nations Cup and Soto Grande international senior debut. So, you know, he's a guy who's very talented for his age. At that age, to be making a debut is something special. And we have a few more really good youngsters, Mark Power, Thomas Mulligan. You know, there's a lot of talent there. It isn't the same for everyone. Kevin is likely to turn pro at a younger age than the Walker Cup 5 did. They were around 23 thereabouts on average when they turned pro. Rory obviously was much younger. Kevin, I imagine, would be somewhere in between. So Neil would work with these players to try and guide them and advise them.
And there was a piece by Philip Reid we meant to talk about a couple of weeks ago, but there's just been a lot going on in the world of golf about how maybe behind the headline acts, which are, you know, Larry and Rory and Harrington, obviously, and the guys we're all very familiar with, that maybe the story isn't so good behind them in terms of the numbers on tour. Is that your sense? Is it getting harder and harder for Irish players just to make it on tour? You know, we had such a cohort for so long, the Damien McGrain level, say, who were doing brilliantly. You know, I don't use that word disparagingly. Like, the Damien McGrain level is still bloody impressive. It seems getting to that level is harder and harder. Can we expect, like, fewer Irish golfers to be making a living on tour over the next decade, or what's your sense?
Yeah, I think the whole scene is changing, isn't it? Like, the PGA Tour, European Tour, World Golf Championships, the top 50 in the world is where you need to be now, really. The if you add up, I think, all the players around on different tours, you know, we've Seamus and Padraig playing on the US on the PGA Tour at the moment. They won't count as European Tour players necessarily in Philip's article, and he did reference that. We're not doing too badly. I think over the last 4 or 5 years, we've been really weak on the Challenge Tour, you know, which is the feeder tour, obviously the normal age for graduation, if you want to call it that, is around 28, you know. So the players turn pro around 23. They have a 5-year period on average in between. And we've been really weak in the last number of years in that area. Whereas now there's a strength coming through. So it's sort of a cyclical thing, I think. And we've got now the 5 Walker Cup players and another bunch with them who are the same generation as them as such, who will be on the European Tour in the next number of years, I hope.
Let's jump into the reason that you're here. So the GUI have launched a Handicap Awareness Month.
Yep.
Talk to us.
We have. Well, I guess there are two reasons behind it. One is to try and educate golfers and indeed non-golfers as to the rules of the handicapping system and how it works. It's a pretty unapproachable subject, I think. You know, if you look at the handicapping booklet, it makes pretty dismal reading. So we're trying to make it a bit more approachable with, you know, more approachable language in this campaign. And the other side of it is, for the first time, I guess, the GUI has called the behaviour whereby somebody's playing off a handicap that's higher than their ability, cheating effectively, because we see no difference in somebody playing off 12 who should be off 10, changing a 6 to a 4 on a scorecard. It's the same thing. Funnily enough, somebody who's off 12 who should be off 10, the majority of those people would never think or dream of changing a 6 to a 4 in a scorecard. Yeah. But so we're trying to create that kind of cultural change to hopefully help the game.
So then, okay, let's go point one first then. I don't find the handicap system that unapproachable. Do you think people misunderstand it? I mean, I just leave it up to my golf club as much as anything. I generally know if I stink the joint out, I get plus one back. If I do well, I'll be cut in accordance with how the field performed. Does that kind of sum it up?
Yeah, it does. But if I asked you to explain the CSS algorithm to me, yeah. You mightn't be...
Well, might I could. It's very simple.
Could you?
Explain standard scratch. Go
I
on,
will, yeah, okay.
Yep.
The machine gets my score, does something, and then at the end of the day, I get my and I trust the machine. No, yeah,
okay. Don't mess with the machine.
Yeah, don't.
I think there are an awful lot of people in the same boat. They just let it happen.
That's fine.
And yeah, it might be fine.
Can you say?
We prefer if people understood.
Would you? Okay. Yeah. Now listen, I've got a low boredom threshold here.
Yeah. Okay.
Can you give it to me in a minute?
CSS or yeah. the whole handicap system.
Tell me what the machine's doing when I hand in
yeah.
my score.
Okay. So the machine is assessing your score
yeah.
and trying to compare it against what a scratch golfer should shoot in the golf course. And in doing so, if more golfers shoot within that range, it lowers the CSS
okay.
so that you get less of a handicap cut. If fewer golfers shoot in that range, it increases the CSS so that your cut is bigger. Because
so if I play brilliantly on a horrible weather day and I'm the only one to get even close to a decent score, that will increase the deduction in my
exactly,
handicap.
Yeah. Okay. It'll, on that kind of a day, a really real stinker of a day, the competition might end up being a reduction-only competition where effectively the CSS is three shots bigger than the rating of the golf course.
Yeah.
But essentially what it's trying to do is it's trying to compare your performance against everybody else in the field to adjust your handicap accordingly. That's what it's really trying to do.
I had an interesting case. You two. You're going to.
Go on.
I bring this up not out of vanity, right? Just it's happened to me, so it's an interesting one.
And it strangely turns Joe into the hero of this story, but proceed.
It's just an interesting one. So I've been improving quite a lot lately, and I had my best ever round at Glen Castle, which was a 75 gross.
Wow.
And I was playing off like 14 or 15 that day.
My God.
Yeah. But I've made a massive jump.
Yeah.
So like I'm down to 12.5 now. But interestingly, the day I shot 75 in Killeen gross was the week after placing had come in. And so I've got the whole winter playing at untouched.
The week before placing?
No, it came in the week after placing. So I wasn't touched.
I
started that day on 12.9. I'd come down from 17 the previous week because I had a great round in Kilcock. You were there. And then placing came in. Another great round at Killeen, 75. They couldn't touch me over the winter.
Yeah.
Is that the general kind of way it goes
They can touch you. It's just that there's no automatic cut as a result of that score. So
it's an observation.
Yeah. There's a thing called the annual review where they should look at all such scores, all scores in non-qualifying competitions, be they singles or four ball or whatever.
I didn't back it up necessarily.
Oh, well, you know what, though? You would have got an ESR as well.
What's that?
Oh, no. If you score two really, really good scores.
Yeah, I did that.
You get the cut for both. And then you get an exceptional score reduction because you did two.
So placing might have saved me then.
I wouldn't like to say that, but placing saved you two cuts.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't like to say it saved you necessarily because you want to be playing off the lowest handicap.
Is this turning into an intervention?
Like,
are you saying that Joe's been cheating for the entire winter?
No, I can say, and I understand. I think what you're talking about, Pat, is there's a cultural shift that needs here. And in fairness, Joe is definitely, I play with Joe all the time. He is absolutely not guilty of this at all. But there is something that is endemic, I would say. And I wonder how you would refer to it. In Irish golf, going back, I mean, decades and decades and decades, is the idea of the club golfer who understands the way the game is played, understands. And so, say, for example, for the Saturday comp, coming up to the captain's or the president's prize is like kind of, oh, look, I three-putted the last three greens or, you know, and then all of a sudden, and is making sure that the handicap that they want is at a competitive level going into the captain's prize, and all of a sudden they're playing two shots better than their average.
Yeah.
And as you say, that's always subject to the mutterings in the club bar. And it's like, did you see your man? Or, you know, how do you tackle that?
Well, I think that's just it. I think it, you know, you see it happening and it's tolerated. You know, within golf, it's tolerated. Yeah, there might be mutterings in the bar, but there's nothing done about it. And, you know, from a governing body perspective, the GUI tolerated it for 20 years. You know, we never came out and said, this is not on, you can't do this, this is cheating.
Mm. But how do you how do you label something as cheat? How do you say you deliberately three-putted that?
Yeah, well, okay.
There are times Fiona's misputs, and I thought...
That yips off the tee thing. Totally made up.
There's tee shots Fiona's hit, and I thought, come on.
Yeah.
There's no way that's possible.
Okay.
Like, intent is everything, so it's difficult. Yeah. And we've all hit shocking golf shots.
Yeah. Yeah, but you're not going to judge it on one shot. I mean, sure. I think we all have played with or all know players who have a few shots up their sleeve. Mm-hmm. And
how prevalent do you think it is?
It's impossible to answer that question, but it's possibly more prevalent in other areas of Ireland than it is in some.
So what counties?
Yeah.
Kerry people.
I'm not going to get into it. You're not going to be drawn into that kind of conversation.
I mean, I played in lots of golf. It is. I think it's an endemic issue. I don't mean it's just that like every golf club has 15 bandits. I mean that every golf club has a bandit or more.
Yeah.
But such is life. Like, but I applaud you guys coming out and I applaud the campaign. Handicap awareness. I would argue everybody knows that goes on. It's not that it's tolerated. It's just like, am I going to go and confront some guy in the bar and make a big scene? And sure, look, if someone wants to cheat and be an idiot, then good luck to them. And it's a hollow victory if they occasionally win.
Says the guy who doesn't care about the captain's prize.
Yeah, but if you're facing a four-footer on the last green the week before the captain's prize and the month end is in between or whatever, and your choice is, if I miss this, I get 0.1, I'm up to 13 next week or 12. Mm. People within, I've played golf for 25 years or whatever, and people do that who would never, ever dream of changing a 5 to a 4. So this is the part of this is about telling people, it's actually worse. It's because it's premeditated. It's cheating in the first degree almost, you know. Mm. And if we can stamp out, say, 8 out of 10 handicap bandits on the basis of telling them you're actually cheating. Mm. I know people who I'm friends with people who are engaged in this behaviour who definitely would not kick a ball in the rough or improve their lie in the rough or you know, drop a ball down their trouser leg or whatever else.
Yeah.
But they simply don't see this as cheating. They see it as a culturally accepted phenomenon within golf. Yeah, absolutely.
That's interesting. I would have thought it's just so obviously cheating that everybody would be aware and just who cares.
And your mindset is to go out and try your hardest every time. So we need more people thinking like
that. Well, I just think, you know, nobody, I've said this to you before plenty of times, and Nathan, nobody, when they're chatting golf, says to someone, like for instance, you were talking with Alan just off air. You don't say, what have you won in the game? You say, what's your handicap? So I think like the mark of a golfer is your handicap. So I want to be the lowest I can ever be, as opposed to say, oh, I won a captain's prize in 2011.
But I think that you, because, and this is in no disrespect to your take on golf, because I'm with Pat, I think it's a good attitude to have. But you come to the golf relatively late, like you didn't really play when you were young. So when you're a member of a golf club, winning the captain's is a big, big deal. And if a guy is cute and kind of can go, oh, look, he avoided being cut the 0.1 that is going to give him an extra shot. That's seen as culturally acceptable. It's not seen as cheating.
Is it not?
No, it's seen as like playing.
Let me tell you a little anecdote to try and illustrate the point. So I was at a funeral probably 6-7 years ago, and the priest from the pulpit said, in talking about the deceased, said, and he had a fair golfer, and he had a few shots up his sleeve. Now there is, and there was a chuckle from the church. You know, everyone kind of thought, yeah, he would never say, oh, you know, he changed his 6 to a 4 in the scorecard and won the captain's prize as a result. You know,
fair enough.
So that's the kind of cultural thing we're trying to tap into and change.
And I think if I may, I think why that is so endemic and so embedded, and not just in Ireland. But it is embedded in Ireland. I've also noticed it in England. Is precisely because those same golfers would never dream about changing a 6 to a 4 because they're so conscious about the self-policing aspect of golf. They understand it's a noble sport and you're meant to police your own behaviour. That somehow this, because it's not included as part of the general area of, well, you know, that's cheating. So therefore, that's why it's so allowed. Or not even allowed, why it's so accepted as being part of the norms of playing golf.
But what then are you proposing that people do? Because it sounds as though you're asking people to open themselves up to a world of pain and almost, I don't know, a world of litigation.
Yeah.
That if somebody changes a 6 to a 4, there's a very good chance that their playing partner will notice and go, wait a second, I saw that you had 3 putts. To actually watch somebody over a 3, 4, 5 month period and go, something doesn't stack up here.
Yeah, so if you were involved in this kind of behaviour, where you went out and didn't try your hardest every time, and if you listen to this campaign and hear what we're saying, and we say you're cheating, will your behaviour change? Could your behaviour change? We don't know that it will, but we have to try.
Yeah,
so we have to try in the first instance to say, you know, we want you to change your own behaviour. And then the next phase in this is if people don't... We're not saying that anyone has done this up until now has been cheating. I don't think that's correct. I don't think it would be correct to say they have been cheating.
Well, I'll say they have been then.
Okay, fair enough.
They have been.
I wouldn't say they have been because they've been engaged in a culturally acceptable behaviour that wasn't before now, in my view, considered to be cheating.
I can't believe that this was culturally acceptable.
Let's say, for example, you're playing a game of football.
No, I understand.
And you lean in, and some guy gives you a push. It's culturally accepted to kind of fall if you feel a hand on you. But it's technically cheating. But I think the point is a good one is that, let's say, for example, you're sitting with your friends after the round and there is that sense. I've had this conversation. I've heard people say it many times. It's like, well, you know, all of a sudden I left that one a little short because the captain's is coming.
No.
If someone goes, you know what, actually, that's just not cool anymore. You can't do that.
Okay. Well, look,
then it changes the
look,
whole...
Look, I'm surprised. I don't think that culture is there as much, but I accept what you're both saying. So you're drawing a line, Pat, and you want to say from here on in, you'd like people to call any competitors who are doing that on it.
No, I think the first step is that the person changes their own behaviour. Okay. Now that it can't be claimed anymore to be something that's just part of the game. We're calling it cheating. The governing body is saying this is cheating. Mm. So stop is the first message. And then after that, it becomes a bit more tricky. If there are people who are still involved in that behaviour, what I would do is I would just not play with them. So if I go out to play in my monthly medal and I see somebody who I believe to be involved in that kind of behaviour, not trying their hardest, trying to get a point one, whatever, I'll say to them at the end of the round, I think that's what you were at. I can't prove it, but I'm not playing with you again.
Nathan,
I'm not going to put my name down beside you on the timesheet again.
But Nathan made a point, Pat, and without naming names or naming golf clubs, there was a case, a legal case that was taken where someone was labelled a cheat because they were nursing a handicap and they took an action based on the fact that it damaged the reputation, that it was...
Yeah, and lost the action in the High Court after 23 days, I think.
What you're saying is the GUI will fund anyone's legal fees.
Yeah, of course, yeah, no problem. Yeah, absolutely.
How big an issue are, and maybe this isn't an issue at all, but pro-ams in terms of people wanting to do this, without naming names of pro-ams, but there are some pretty big pro-ams in this country that happen every year, that some happen every few years, and people want to play in them. And that almost they plan this from years in advance to just keep their handicap that little bit higher, and then you go watch them play, and they're playing off probably 5 shots lower. Is that something that actually is an issue that comes into people's minds? Or is this more on a low-level captain's prize?
To my mind, judging by the response to the campaign so far, where clubs are saying, thank God, at last somebody is doing something about this. Yeah, absolutely. Right. So to my mind, it's not necessarily to tackle just that. It's a cultural
phenomenon. I think the worst one is some of those charity days where there's like half-decent prizes.
Yeah.
And teams show up and just cheat their way to them.
I think in a lot of those charity days, people who don't even have a GUI card play, and it's because it's charity. Maybe, you accept the 4 ball and you say, you know, I've played in lots of charity days where you're playing with people who don't play golf usually, and you say, what's your handicap? And they say
18, 22.
22.
Or it's lashing rain, I'll be 24. You know, that charity days are maybe a difficult thing to police. But are you anticipating out of this campaign now, whatever about members and a cultural shift, and that's a very vague thing to try and have a feel for, are you anticipating that the head pro in golf clubs will now feel he or she has a license to say to somebody, we think this is what you're doing and we're now calling you on it, where they wouldn't have previously? Is that something, if we're sitting here in a year, the instances of that will go up?
Yeah, I don't think that it wouldn't be the head pro's role anyway. It might be the handicapping committee. But at the same time, no, I wouldn't recommend to anybody that they start getting involved in pointing the finger and saying, you're doing this, you got to stop. Except for everybody doing that and saying after a round, I won't play with you again. Okay. And if the majority of people do that, then it'll leave people who are involved in this behaviour to play amongst themselves in singles events and off with them. You know, we're not going to stamp it out absolutely out of the game. There's no chance of that happening.
Yeah.
But if it's a 10% problem and we can reduce it to a 3% problem, well, we've done good.
Fair enough. Okay, well, listen, thanks a million for coming in to us. Pat Finn, CEO of the GUI. Thanks a million, Pat.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
There we go. That was interesting stuff. Pat Finn, CEO of the GUI. First of all, good of them to come in.
Yeah.
Much appreciated. And, well, it's good they're taking this on. Maybe he does make an interesting point when he says there are parts of the country where it's more prevalent. And we can speculate about that now, or we can just move on.
More prevalent.
it's also prevalent in certain parts.
Yeah, it is prevalent. Right,
you are prevalent.
Right. No. Stop making up words.
Tomato.
I like, this goes back to that earlier conversation that we had 3 months ago about the captain's prize.
Yeah.
That your golf career is very different to a lot of golfers down the country, where the golf club is their life.
Yeah. Mm.
And winning the captain's prize may well be the proudest thing they do
in their life.
In their life.
Not to say something terribly naive, okay, but I'll do it anyway. How hollow would it feel? How hollow must it feel? Now, I take it that that's Pat's point, that maybe it doesn't feel hollow to these people who win it this way because they don't see it as cheating.
We see, I'd say it doesn't feel hollow because it's not as if they have changed their score. It's not as if you're walking in on the 18th worried. You're not walking in going, I might be caught.
And
someone might have seen me kick the ball out. Somebody might know I changed my score.
It's also very easy to rationalise doing it.
To be fair, you still have to play very well.
Yeah.
There's that.
If you have a shot or two, you've still played good golf, so there's a sense of achievement. I accept all that.
It's an easy thing to rationalise to yourself because, like, you're talking the difference of, like, one shot, oftentimes.
Yeah.
And so you can go, I sure just had a bit of a good run. Why should I be punished for that good run early in the year at the captain's?
So what, in your experience, is the attitude to the bandit? The professional band, not just someone we slag sometimes.
Nah, it's really, I think, in my experience, they're generally ostracized.
Mm.
Like, it's considered poor form.
Mm.
Like, I think the vast majority of club golfers go, ugh.
But not quite cheating.
Because here's the thing, and we know Irish people, it's very difficult to point the finger. Like, do you want to be the guy that walks over in the bar and go, you know what? You were cheating. No, nobody does. So it's all kind of, it's all taught. But I think Pat's point is that, and it seems like an inconsequential punishment, but if you kind of all of a sudden avoid their name on the timesheet, that's not good, particularly in the social side of things, where like you don't want to be the golfer that nobody wants to play with.
Well, you'd probably be unaware of
for a while.
It's not a fun place to be, let me tell you.
Has it happened to you? In Ballyhonus?
No.
Do you know a band in Ballyhonus? You must know it.
No. I was only a country member in Ballyhonus because I only joined when I moved to Dublin.
All right.
Oh,
so
right.
I just go down.
We'll go out and do something around the GUI in the summer when the weather picks up. Maybe play a few holes around Carton House and chat with Pat.
And Neil.
Neil about things. Mm. So let's get to other news then before we round this off. So Dermot Gallese, as we mentioned, was in Castleknock on Friday for our day out and he had lots of interesting things to say. The Gary Player stuff is brilliant. There's an alleged cheating incident, seeing as we're on this theme, between Gary Player and Watson. Actually, it's not alleged. It happened in this instance. Sorry. Full-on cheating.
That's why it's still in the podcast.
Yes, correct. Okay, so it's in the podcast. He tells lots of great stories. He's brilliant on Monty. Stephen Brown, formerly of the European Tour, was there as well. Had lots of good stories on Monty. But invariably, it was weird, you know? We've edited this little conversation out, but Nathan and I turned to each other about three quarters of the way through the conversation and we just said, what else should we talk about? Is there anything we should hit upon? And the first thing someone shouted was, Tiger! You'd think people would be sick of talking about Tiger, but it was the first thing someone shouted. So we were talking to Dermot about Tiger.
I have heard that he's not going to play in the Masters.
Right.
And if that happens, I think we've seen the end. I think he lost it on two levels, physically and mentally. I mean, I think his womanizing destroyed him mentally. I mean, he destroyed a marriage which had given him two beautiful children whom he adores.
Yeah.
And he must be kicking himself from here into Dublin and back again at how he allowed that to happen. Mm. And then, of course, the physical aspect of which the only control he had would have been in the 90s. I mean, I think when he went beyond the 90s, I think the damage Stephen might be able to, well, would be able to say more about it. But I think he did enormous physical damage in the early years on tour when he and John Daly were the only two players hitting the ball over 300 yards. And we had the Tiger proofing of Augusta National, which actually did happen. I mean, they won't tell you that, but it did happen. He did tremendous damage, I have no doubt, to his back at that time and to his knees.
And that's a snippet of what you get from Gleese. But interestingly, Steve Stricker, who named Woods as one of his President Cup assistants last year, has been talking with Woods by text message. And Stricker's not prone to hyperbole or exaggerating things, but he said...
He's no nut to be gay.
No, he said, I don't think he's doing that well right now physically, was the line, which actually, even though it's not that dramatic...
No, it is. It's that lack of drama, that lack of hyperbole that makes it all the more serious.
And Stricker said he watched Woods' opening round 77 in Dubai, which we all watched, and said just the way he was walking didn't look right to me. He was walking really gingerly, really didn't look physically like he was ready to play.
He can't even lean down and take a ball out of
the hole. There's no pop, there's no dynamism in the movement. The other point to mention is Mike Davis, Executive Director and CEO of USGA, was at the North American Golf Innovation Symposium. A conference.
Can't believe we missed
a meeting
that.
To discuss a particular subject.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Is the definition.
As
so
you were.
Davis offered up the notion of, quote, a variable distance golf ball. So it's an optional tool by which bombers like Dustin Johnson might use a ball built to 80% capacity. According to Davis's reasoning, it would curb the current rush to perpetually lengthen modern courses and bring some old school designs back into play. He said, throw Dustin an 80% golf ball and say, let's go play the back tees. And guess what? It would be a great experience for him, Davis said. He'd be able to play this wonderful historic golf course that, by and large, he can't play anymore.
Yeah, because that's exactly what Dustin Johnson wants. Is the suggestion here is that long hitters would have to play the 80% ball and everyone else can play just a regular ball?
I don't think
It doesn't make any sense. Because I've just done a rough calculation. So if you hit the ball on average 300 yards and your 20% less is 240, and you hit it 280, which is sort of GMAC territory, 20% off is 224. So you're literally gaining 4 yards on the longer hitters if you're a shorter hitter.
Yeah.
And also, it's completely unfair.
Yeah.
Change the ball completely if you want to change it. Like, it's like turning around to Tiger Woods in 2000 and going... Do you know what would make golf more interesting for you, Tiger? If we added 5 shots to each of your tournaments, then it'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
There was also a recent report, anyway, by the USGA, which stated, I don't know if this is true, but it stated that distance gains amongst professionals have been pretty negligible since 2003. That doesn't feel true.
That doesn't feel right, because
that's what the USGA report says.
But if you look at average... In the USGA, but if you're looking at average yards, say driving distance, it's over the 300 for a chunk of players now.
Mm,
10 years ago, it wasn't that case.
No, but you see, I guess maybe the issue is, so if it is now if the average is 305 or something and the average was 295, but courses were built for 295.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Graeme McDowell weighed in on this. He was speaking over at the Valspar Championship where he's playing, and he was saying how they have to do something. He was talking about how, you know, the alarm bell started going off when they put the 17th tee at St Andrews back 50 yards. You've got one of the most iconic golf holes maybe in the world being kind of torn up and having to be reinvented because guys are hitting it too far. And Charles Schwartzel was asked about it and he thought it would actually help pace of play. Now you have to walk 150 yards back and then walk this way, so you're walking 300 yards and you're still in the same place. He's talking about like the tee positions.
Oh.
If you can make the balls and clubs go shorter and you can play the old courses, then the game will be 3.5 hours again. It's simple. But you've got to walk so far. How are you going to play quick? It's impossible to play quick.
I think those are all valid points. I mean, I don't really take the point about the 17th of St Andrews. This is a course laid out in the 1860s. It's like...
Well, McDowell says something's going to happen because we're starting to lose the integrity of some of the most beautiful courses in the world. They're being outdated, which is just a little scary, really.
It's true. I think Jack Nicklaus said...
The horse has bolted, I think.
But Jack Nicklaus said 20 years ago that golf ball technology...
Yeah, was the problem.
...was the problem, not the
Because,
clubs.
Interestingly, Dermot Gleese was in a while back and he did a brilliant thing where he went out and asked...
Noel Fox. That's right, with the 3-iron.
To hit one of Christy Senior's 3-irons.
That's right.
And the difference between Christie's three iron and a current hybrid
4 yards
was negligible. Yeah. Nothing. So it
it's that the sweet spot on the new three rescue
much easier.
Is massive.
But it's not like there was a 50-yard difference,
no.
Which was very interesting. So it was about the ball.
It's no surprise that it's Graham McDowell who's leading the charge on this because he's one of the players worst affected.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and before him, I remember when Paul McGinley was doing the Ryder Cup winning tour after sinking the putt, whatever it was, all those years ago.
He won the Ryder Cup?
Do you remember? Went into the water afterwards. Yeah, probably a long time ago. He talked a lot about yards, and you could see in himself. Now, he was smart enough not to radically overhaul his own swing, looking for extra yards. But he made no secret of the fact that he goes, this is a guy who'd worked really, really hard, become a professional golfer, hit the ball as straight as anything I've ever seen, and yet could not compete on tour, really, because he just didn't have distance.
Yeah, so we'll see where that goes. I mean, it won't go anywhere, but it's Mike Davis floating this whole idea.
Obviously, these are just preliminary discussions, but putting a cap on golf ball technology seems like such an obvious thing. I don't see why that's such a big problem.
You'll upset sponsors?
Why? Sorry, maybe I'm being stupid, but no, why?
It's a fair point. You'll still need to use golf balls.
Yeah, you still need to use golf balls. So you just say, from now on, it's a bit like in Formula One.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's the same manufacturer, same engines, the same everything. You just kind of restrict it and say, you can't make a golf ball like this. This is how you can make a golf ball, and everybody is off the same.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe equalising the golf ball is something which should happen anyway. Yeah. Poor old Bubba Watson with his terrible golf ball.
Oh, yeah.
Like, maybe all golfers should be using the same golf ball.
Well, or that, you know, I mean, obviously, that it goes back to your sponsors issue. It's like, a half dozen golf ball manufacturers, that they all have to make a similar type of golf ball.
Yeah.
Like, I don't see why that's, I don't see how that's massively problematic. Yeah. And maybe I'm missing something huge.
The little Nike swoosh is still there.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Is there anything else someone wants to say before we wrap her up?
No, I think we've gone long enough at this stage.
Yeah, it's a long old
pod.
This will bring us through to next week.
We've done about 8 hours in the last week. Okay, we will talk to you next week. At Golf Weekly NT is where you'll get us for anything. Goodbye. All my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here in Dardanelle, all picket now. Little JD starter kit right here.